You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Hello and welcome to another BSR podcast today. We're going to be talking to you about the Sjögren's syndrome guidelines, and we have some experts with us in the room. I'll start with the introductions. My name is Marwan Bukhari. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Rheumatology, and I'll introduce you to our experts who will be chatting with us today. We'll start off with Liz.
Hi, I'm Liz Price. I'm a consultant rheumatologist at the Great Western Hospital in Swindon. I've got a clinical interest in Sjögren's syndrome.
I'm Ben Fishers. I'm a professor of rheumatology at Birmingham, and I've got an interest particularly in clinical trials in Sjögren's syndrome.
Hi, I'm Kosiana Turkin. I'm a professor of rheumatology at UCL, and I'm a consultant in adolescent and adult rheumatology with interest in Sjögren.
Hello, my name's Bridget Crampton, and I lead the helpline team at Sjögren's UK, and I also have Sjögren's myself. I've had it for 20 years now.
Well, welcome all to the podcast, and we are trying to discuss really the most recent update to the guidelines and what's new in it. So let's start off with a brief summary. Liz, can you tell us what's in the guideline and what's new, please?
So the original guideline was published in 2017, and things move on very rapidly. So the update, we've approached in a slightly different way. So in the old guideline, we went eyes, mags, and so forth, and just worked our way through bits of the systemic effects, if you like, of the Sjögren's syndrome. This time, we posed questions that we felt needed to be asked. So what we actually did was the guideline working group got together and came up with a set of 19 questions. And then we interrogated the literature and we've come up with the answers and used that to develop our recommendations. We've broadened the guideline. So this time we've included a lot more that wasn't in the original guideline, including for the first time advice on adolescents. And Kosiana's been instrumental in that. And the idea of the guideline is that it's to enable the non-specialist rheumatologist to manage a patient with Sjögren's in the best possible way, looking at the important things, making sure they do all the little things well, they treat the eyes, they treat the mouth, they think of a holistic patient, they look at what blood tests they should be looking at, and really to guide the rheumatologist or the specialist nurse or whoever's looking after them to do the best way of managing these guidelines to make sure that the patient gets a holistic treatment and management in the best possible way.
That's interesting, because what about in patients with adolescents? Is there anything new there to report from the guidelines?
Yes, I think what the British Society of Rheumatology proposed here is a first at the international level, and I think this is terribly relevant. There is no other guideline that looks at Sjögren's disease or Sjögren's syndrome across age. That means for the first time we recognize that there is an underdiagnosed and possibly underrecognized disease phenotype that starts in younger patients, and also that they present slightly differently and they may have different needs, and also we need to support our clinicians and the allied health professionals in diagnosing and looking after them. That means there are a few new things there. First, quite reassuring that even if there is research around novel autoantibodies, they don't help diagnosis. That means we are reassured as NHS clinicians that whatever we do routinely in our clinics, testing for anti-low, anti-low antibodies, rheumatoid factor, ANA is likely to be sufficient. There is some evidence that we can use ultrasound and we can use it targeting different salivary glands. We can look at the parotid glands or the submandibular glands, and that can help the diagnosis. And also that doing biopsies is reasonably safe in children as well. And the biopsies may need to be targeted according to their involvement. There is some update on medication, and we've been quite careful to try to map the evidence, which unfortunately is not very, very strong because there are very few studies. And as we know from adults, there is absolutely no licensed medication. However, there are some updates. Specifically, we have access to cyclosporine. If patients, younger patients, have very severe eye dryness, we can use that in the UK now from age 4, and that wasn't available a few years ago. Also, the fact that we have some guidelines that are targeted to the recurrent parotitis. Recurrent parotitis is the most common manifestation of the young people. That means understanding the way we can treat them is terribly relevant. And also we looked at the evidence we have about using conventional and biologic DMARDs across the world, using information that was provided by our American colleagues who surveyed their practice. And we know that there are some agents that can be used in children, and we map this across the guideline.
Brilliant. That's great. Thank you. It's really interesting that this is actually the first in children. And Bridget, from the patient point of view, I mean, what do you think this will provide all the patients get from this?
I think it's great for patients that we have guidelines like this. I think it means that all clinicians can easily access information and actually knowledge. I think by my experience, I find knowledge is a little bit patchy in places. So not everyone is able to access good care, or people don't have the knowledge to direct them to the right specialists. And I think it will help them to access that. So that will be great for patients. I think also that it's good that patients can access it themselves. It will help them make better use of their own appointments. So they'll know what treatments might be offered. They'll know what they want to talk about at their appointments. This moment in time, appointments are precious time. They don't want to waste it. They want to know what they want to talk about. So, and I think it really helps patients to do that. But it's great for clinicians to access this information. And my hope is it might standardise care across the UK a little bit more and iron out some of this patchiness.
I think it's worth saying, Marwan, that one of the issues that I come across in the patients that come to see me for a second opinion is that very often the little things haven't been done well. So I think people make the diagnosis of Sjögren's and then give them hydroxychloroquine and send them away. And people don't think about managing their eye disease, managing their mouth disease, managing the dryness, vaginal dryness and so forth. And I think the trouble with Sjögren's is there isn't a single treatment that suits everyone. You really have to personalise the care, and you have to go through, it is a bit tedious, but you do have to go through all the little bits. And actually, the one thing that I try and teach the registrars is actually ask the patients about their dry eyes, ask them what drops they're using and what frequency they're using. And it's something that is a bit out of the comfort zone for rheumatologists. So if we can get across to rheumatologists particularly, this is a systemic disease that affects different parts of the system, and make them think, have I asked the right questions? Am I referring them in the right direction? Do they need to see a specialist dentist, for instance? Do they need an ophthalmology review to start Icovis, cyclosporine eye drops? That sort of thing. I think that is really valuable. I think rheumatologists get very, very focused on immunomodulation. And we know that the evidence for immunomodulation in Sjögren's is not good. And we do use it, but actually that isn't your first line of defence in this condition. You've got to do the simple things first. And I think we forget that sometimes.
I think that's really important. And it goes back, Liz, to you talking about a holistic approach. And I think living with Sjögren's, it's what we need most, really. And the things that make life difficult with Sjögren's are often a collection of small things, really, that you live with day in, day out. And you do need support in finding what is available to help you with those. So I think, yeah, I think you're right.
I think you've mentioned benchmarking and everything else. I'm hoping that there's an audit tool that goes with it so that people can actually look at how they manage Sjögren's and that will help everybody manage it better. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So the idea of the audit tool is it reminds you, am I making the diagnosis correctly? And although we know that ultrasound is phenomenally helpful, it isn't yet part of the diagnostic criteria. So really for a cast iron diagnosis, you need to have done the antibodies and all the biopsy. And then if you look at the order of the things in the audit tool, the simple things are at the top. You know, have you prescribed eye drops 4 times a day? The very basic stuff that I think we often forget.
That's great. Thank you. What about the outcome measures? Because the ESSDAI doesn't necessarily resonate with a rheumatologist. How do you measure the disease in Sjögren's?
So the SDI is a measure that's largely used within clinical trials. It's a measure of systemic disease activity. You're right, there are some challenges with it. It's a very blunt tool. And you know, some of the trials with drugs which we think might work actually seem to have not shown signal with the SDI. The other thing that's a problem with the SDI is, of course, it doesn't measure symptoms. And symptoms are something which really matter to patients and are a big contributor to the poor health-related quality of life. So what we're looking for is, yes, drugs that can affect the systemic disease, because that is also important from a clinical perspective, but also drugs that eventually will improve the symptom burden, which is important to patients. I think hopefully over the next few years we'll see some drugs which are capable of doing both those things.
Okay. So looking at fatigue, as a clinical rheumatologist, the one thing a patient with Sjögren's will come and tell me is I'm tired. And I'm going, I really don't know how to help you. Will these guidelines help us?
So these guidelines will give some basic evidence around management of fatigue. A lot of that is around some of the measures which are common to fatigue it broadly in other conditions as well. So it's not unique to Sjögren's syndrome. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where we don't have any drugs which have been proven to change fatigue. So that's disappointing for our patients. I'm hoping it's a space which will change in the next few years.
So if a disease is driven by rheumatoid factor and IgG levels,
Why do you think things like IL-6 inhibitors or small molecules haven't proven their efficacy?
So it's a good question. I think we need to be thinking what is particularly different about the pathology of Sjögren's syndrome. So, for example, there are some drugs that have been tested now which targeting more effectively B-cell depletion within tissue. I think also the drugs which impact the way that B and T cells talk to each other, drugs targeting the CD40 pathway, are going to be an exciting development, and there should be data out within the next 12 months that I think will be of interest around that sort of area. But I think the other challenging issue is really understanding actually what drives the fatigue. You know, how much of that is directly driven by the immune process that's ongoing? How much of it is something that's slightly downstream of that? So maybe processes which are there to in our body to switch off inflammation are also driving fatigue. You know, some of the drivers of it are not entirely clear. So we need to get a better understanding of that to truly be able to target the problem.
Well, that's brilliant. So I think we've got some interesting data here, and we've got something new, and we've got somewhere to signpost people to when they log on to Google and the search engines, or they go to the BSR website or the Versus Arthritis website or the Sjögren's UK website. Do you have any final things that you might want to mention about the guidelines that we haven't mentioned?
Well, I hope it raises awareness that this is a disease that can affect the ages. I think it's often not thought about in younger people, and it's often not thought about in men. So I think those are two things that I would want to highlight.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think also it's important that it lays out the different things that can happen with Sjögren's. It doesn't always present in the same way. I think a lot of people who know a little bit about Sjögren's think in terms of dryness, but sometimes that's not what we see first. And it can get missed then. So I'm hoping that it brings all this information together and diagnosis will maybe speed up, which would be great.
I fully agree with this. And I think Bridget's view is really, really relevant. According to age, they can have different manifestations, but I feel the guidelines helps us as clinicians to try to stratify our patients and also identify different phenotypes, think about them in a slightly different way in terms of the way we approach the treatment. And discussing about the risk of lymphoma, I think the guidance provides a lot of evidence around that, how we try to map different kind of a presentations that will lead to more extraglandular manifestations. And those will be the refractory cases where we may need to escalate therapy. But also looking at the evidence about the benefits of hydroxychloroquine, I think having that critical appraisal, a treatment that we've been using for so many years, put it into the context of real benefits and evidence base, I think that's very, very useful as well. And the practical advice, I always value a guideline that has non-pharmacological kind of recommendations, and I think it's really good to look into that, as well as the information we can provide to our patients to support them to self-manage.
Just two final points from me. One is that in the course of doing the guidelines and the revision process, we looked at changing the name from Sjögren's syndrome to Sjögren's disease. And we've had feedback from the Europeans and from the patients that they preferred the name disease as it changed the emphasis of the condition. And there is a move away from eponymous syndromes. So we have in this guideline referred to it as Sjögren's disease. I think in time we might lose the disease as well and it might just become Sjögren, but we felt it was a little bit too early to do that. And then finally, you will know that BSR have extended the data capture for the NIA audit this year and are including patients with newly diagnosed CTD, including Sjögren. So a plea from me, we really do not know the incidence of this condition across the UK. If you can put all your newly diagnosed Sjögren's patients into the audit, that will help us tremendously. Can I urge you to use the most modern criteria, which are referred to in the guidelines, the ACR EULAR combined 2016 criteria. The first author on that paper is Shiboshki et al, if you need to look it up. But if you look at the audit tool that goes along with the guideline, the first item in the audit tool is, have you met the guidelines? And there's a little tick box for you to do.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thank you all very much. So just on behalf of the BSR, thank you very much, Liz. Thank you, Kasianika. Thank you, Bridget, for the time. And hopefully we'll be talking about this in a few more years' time when you have more data to show us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.